WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, Winona Ryder was nominated for an Academy Award for her performance in Little Women. My guest is the director of the film, Gillian Armstrong. Here's Winona Ryder as Jo, expressing her feelings of inadequacy to her mother, played by Susan Sarandon.
Well, of course Aunt March prefers Amy over me. Why shouldn't she? I'm ugly and awkward, and I always say the wrong things. I fly around throwing away perfectly good marriage proposals. I love our home, but I'm just so fitful, and I can't stand being here. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Mommy. There's just something really wrong with me. I want to change, but I can't. And I just know I'll never fit in anywhere.
Oh, Joe. Joe, you have so many extraordinary gifts. How can you expect to lead an ordinary life?
The director of this classic American story is from Australia. Gillian Armstrong's first feature film, My Brilliant Career, was set in the Australian outback at the turn of the century. It starred Judy Davis as a young woman determined to defy convention and become a writer. Armstrong also directed Mrs. Sofel, High Tide, Starstruck, and The Last Days of Shay New. I asked Gillian Armstrong how old she was when she first read Little Women.
Well, I actually found my childhood copy after I sent the screenplay. I had a feeling I'd kept it, and it was given to me on my 11th birthday.
Now, what did it mean to you then, and then rereading it as an adult before you made the movie, did the meaning of it change?
Yes, the meaning changed totally. When I read it when I was 11, I thought I was Jo. When I read it at a later age, I thought I was Mommy. So, yes. In the 30 or so years that had passed, I read it from a different point of view. I read it from the mother's point of view.
Do you remember how you felt when you were young when Jo marries the older professor?
No, I think I definitely wish she'd marry Laurie, as most people did. But I can't actually really remember whether or not I was shocked and horrified at the descriptions of the professor who was portly and had a beard.
Right.
Because I think I probably was.
Well, I think a lot of girls, when they read the story, they're just mortified that she should marry this kind of a drab elderly man. You know, that's how it reads when you're a girl.
Well, that's actually the one thing that we updated. We felt poor Louisa, writing in that era where she didn't really even want to marry off her heroine. So, you know, she was forced by public opinion and her publishers to find a man for Jo. And even though I think the character she created in the was almost like the modern woman's version of the ideal man, that was he loved her for what she was, as she was. He respected her talent and supported it and encouraged it. And he was also kind and loving and with children, good with children. But we felt the one additional thing that we should add as modern women, that he was also adorable and sexy and there was some sexual attraction. I think that definitely was something she couldn't write about, that is the sexual attraction part of the story, in the 1870s. And yet at the end she says, you know, I love you and I want to marry you. So we felt Gabriel Byrne was definitely the answer here.
Right. Were there any other parts of the story that you thought women or girls today would have trouble relating to that you wanted to change a little bit?
No, actually, the rest of the story, I mean, I think that the hardest thing for her to write about was sexuality. The way she portrayed her sisters was very, very honest, and I think that's really the key to why the book has survived the test of time.
Did you have sisters or brothers?
I had one sister and one brother.
Older, younger?
And I've got two daughters who I have to pull apart, and one day one of them's going to burn the other one's book.
Burn the other one's copy of Little Women?
No, her own manuscript, just like Amy did to Jo.
Oh, yes. right, throw it in the fireplace.
That's right.
Oh, right. So you have to be Marmy now. And then
I'm Marmy now, yes.
Yeah. So did you go back and watch earlier versions of Little Women, earlier film versions?
No, I decided not to. I thought that the best thing was to go back to the book and to bring the book alive and to ignore the other versions. I thought it'd be too complicated.
Had you seen them anyways? Had you seen them before?
I have a very, very vague memory of an image of Katharine Hepburn walking across the floor, and that's all I remember.
Right.
No, I felt it would really block me. Mm-hmm. You know, I might be shooting a scene, and because I've got a very visual memory, obviously, that's my skilled area. I don't remember anything else but images. And I even the shot to the other movies would have come back, and I felt I couldn't have possibly have made the film if I'd seen the other films.
My guest is Gillian Armstrong, director of Little Women. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Gillian Armstrong. She directed Little Women. She also directed My Brilliant Career, Mrs. Sofel, and High Tide. Your first feature film, My Brilliant Career, you made that when you were 27, and you were the first woman to direct a feature film in Australia. Did you think being a woman would be an obstacle to you having a career in film?
I didn't really think about it. My background is art school, and I learned about filmmaking as a means of visual expression. And coming from that sort of environment, we thought of ourselves as filmmakers. I didn't ever set out to be a film director. I actually wanted originally to be a set designer, costume designer. And there was no film industry in Australia when I went to film school. So for all those reasons, I didn't have huge ambitions about being a director. But then I learnt through that course that everything that I was interested in, that was storytelling, drama, and the visual arts came together for me in filmmaking. So it was really just something that I felt I was learning to do and that I wanted to keep learning about. And then there was a point in my life where I had to sort of figure out, well, how on earth do I make a living from this? Because this is what I like doing the best.
Well, do you think it was helpful to begin at a time when there was virtually no film industry in Australia? And then there was the beginning of what was described as the Australian New Wave, directors like you and Peter Weir, and Bruce Beresford, and who am I leaving out?
Philip Noyce, Fred Skepsey.
Yeah. So, I mean, you were one of the directors who, you know, was part of that.
Yes, Fred Skepsey, Peter Weir, and Bruce Beresford were like just a fraction ahead of me. They're all a little bit older. And then I was like in this sort of second wave with Philip Noyce. But I know it was. I mean, it was the reason that... why a woman was directing a major film in that little country, Australia, or little population, big country, compared to many other countries in the world. It was because it was a young industry. It wasn't established. And it also came from an arts-based, you know, the people in power were set up, you know, in government positions to help encourage film as a culture in Australia. And so really nobody thought twice about... whatever sex either the producer or the director were, it was really if there was a good project or and if you had talent. And at that point I'd made about 6 short films, and I'd directed 2 documentaries, and my short films had won a lot of awards and so on. So it was sort of just natural that amongst my male colleagues I was being offered feature projects to direct.
When you started directing, did you have any problems asserting your authority, or were you self-conscious about using it, you know, as one of the early women in the industry?
There was obviously a lot of talk and fuss when I directed Brilliant Career, and there was, you know, so much so that I really basically had to shut it out to actually go out and do the job. But what I learned many years ago when I was a student and trying to, like, pay the rent, I had a job doing wedding photos. And the first time I had to photograph a wedding and the couple were coming out of the church, I was absolutely terrified and very nervous and wondering what on earth I should do. And then I realized as the family came out of the church, the bride, the groom and their parents, they were really nervous and they didn't know what to do. And basically they needed me, and they needed me to tell them where to stand and to, you know, to come together, and can mum be on here, and, you know, let's get little sister down the front. So that's when I realised that directing isn't necessarily anything to do with asserting your authority. It's sort of like the role of that person. If you're the person on the set who's the director, then it's natural that you therefore have to know what it's all about and how to pull it together.
Did you have the confidence that you were supposed to have at the time, or did you fake it so everybody else could be confident too?
I've been faking it for years. That's what it's all about. I mean, the person who's a leader has to seem at least to be in control, or else there will definitely be panic.
Right, right. Now, you cast Judy Davis, in My Brilliant Career. That was her first film role, I believe.
Yes, it was.
I mean, she's wonderful.
She's one of the, I was very lucky for my first film, I found one of the world's best actors.
Well, how did you find her?
When I say I found her, the casting director had found her. I mean, she wasn't hard to find. She was a graduate of the National Institute of Dramatic Art, which is like RADA in England. You know, she'd done 3 years of drama. She was in Mel Gibson's year. And when we were casting the film, I actually saw her photo in the actors' directory show cast and said to the casting director, "Who is that wonderful girl with that great, extraordinary face?" And she said, "Don't even think about her. She's not available." She went straight to a regional theatre company, you know, to pay her dues and to be like a maid and a carrier of spears. And then very fortunately for me, 6 months later, when we were about ready to shoot, and we started testing again, and Judy at that time was free. And so it was extraordinary good luck, because I could have made the film with somebody else, and I would not be sitting here today.
The one thing I'll say about Judy Davis, though, it's, you know, there's a scene where she's weeping because she's too plain. And it really is hard to conceive of Judy Davis as being too plain, so plain that it causes great agony in her life.
I want to talk to you about this. Now, come on. I bet you're extremely beautiful. And I bet when you were 13, you looked in the mirror and you cried because you didn't look like Sybil Shepherd or whoever you were meant to look like at that time. I think that...
I'll stop you. I'm truly not.
Woman thinks she's beautiful.
Uh-huh.
Helena Christensen cries and wishes her nose wasn't so wide, or whatever her, you know, some tiny detail that's wrong is. It's the reason I directed My Brilliant Career. The very thing that you've said then, because a man said to me, "Well, whoever you cast for Sybilla will have to be really plain," and I said, "But why? I mean, it was that reason that made me feel it was very important that a woman directed the film, because I think that only a woman knows that a young woman writing a book about herself and describing herself as plain and could actually possibly be actually not that necessarily plain. I mean, the whole thing about adolescence for women and girls is it's a period when you realize for the first time in your life that your looks matter. I mean, maybe unfortunately in this era, girls realize that at 3, probably now in America, that that unfortunately that's the game. A woman's appearance matters. It's part of her sort of trading card in life. And that's why most adolescent girls are so unhappy. And also in every era, there have been very narrow images of beauty, of what is the accepted beauty of the time. And therefore, it's very easy to be both beautiful, but to consider yourself plain. And, you know, and to consider your legs are too big or your hands are too small, or and all the things that we're led to believe that are necessary for us to accept ourselves as beautiful in this world.
I'm going to express my gripe anyways, not necessarily with your films, but with actresses. In Hollywood, it seems on the occasions when someone is supposed to be genuinely
plain. Can I say one more thing?
Yes.
Judy Davis does not like how she looks.
No kidding.
She doesn't think she's a beautiful woman.
Wow.
And she never did. And every night that she saw dailies when I was shooting that film, she cried. Because she thought I made her look so ugly.
Wow.
So that is, it's a very important thing. And women should address this problem with ourselves and be more accepting of what we are. But I actually think that Judy, to contradict myself totally, has ability to be both sort of plain and extremely beautiful, like Jodie Foster does. I think that's an incredible quality.
Well, yeah, sure. Great actors can do that.
Well, no, it's a physical thing that some people have.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, when Judy Davis would watch the dailies and weep because she felt you made her look too plain or unattractive, did you feel bad about it, or did you just feel she just really can't see herself, or what?
I feel bad that any of my actors is upset. I stopped letting her come. But I also...
Really? You stopped letting her come?
Oh, yeah,
screen?
Yeah. There was no point. But there's no point if deep down you can never accept what you are. But I also told her that I think, and everyone on the crew thought she's beautiful, but she wouldn't believe us. She thought we were all just, you know, having her on.
My guest is Gillian Armstrong, director of Little Women and My Brilliant Career. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Gillian Armstrong. She directed Little Women, also directed My Brilliant Career, Mrs. Sofol, and High Tide. You made Mrs. Sofol in 1984.
Did I? Let me think.
I wrote that date down from Leonard Maltin's book, so he
oh, well, Leonard would get it right. Leonard would get it right. Thanks, Leonard. Yes.
And it's interesting. This film is set in the same period as My Brilliant Career, although it's just really counter to it in so many ways. It's set in 1901 in a prison in Pittsburgh, and it's based on a true story of a woman who's married to a warden, and she falls in love with one of the prisoners who's awaiting execution, who she initially goes to comfort, and then she starts to believe in his innocence. So she actually helps him escape and then runs off with him and his brother, who was also ready to be executed. Diane Keaton played Mrs. Sofel. Mel Gibson was the prisoner who she runs off with. Matthew Modine, his brother. I like this film. I know it wasn't a hit. Why did you want to do the movie?
Not a hit, but very loved. Loved by many of us. Mm-hmm. I was very interested in passion. I was very interested in not only why did Mrs. Sofel fall in love with the prisoner, played by Mel Gibson, who, and the prisoner, the real prisoner, was like a Mel Gibson of his time. He was apparently very charismatic. He had an extraordinary following, even when there were, the court case was on. You know, there were groupies outside the jail and in the court every day because he was so... so handsome, and he wrote very romantic, wrote poetry, and so on. But I was also intrigued about why he fell in love with her, and he obviously did, because the most stupid thing they did was to actually stick together once they'd escaped. They all would have been much better if they'd separated, and obviously less easy to trace. So for me, the fascination with the story was a two-way thing. She was a very conservative middle-class woman who, and she really did go around the jail reading the Bible to the prisoners. I was interested in both why she gave up everything, gave up her life, her husband and her children to run off with him, but also why he finally fell in love with her, and also why his brother stayed with them. To me, that was the dynamics that was fascinating of, you know, why we are what we are, why we do what we do, so... And it was a beautiful screenplay written by Ron Nisewiner. And it was very seductive when I was presented the screenplay and an image of the jail, which we actually filmed in the real jail in Pittsburgh, where the story happened.
Was the jail in use at the time?
It was. It was very busy, quite packed. And a number of the real inmates were extras for us. And the others had worked very conscientiously with the art department, restoring and painting and so on, so that, you know, the jail looked totally correct for period.
So you used interiors as well as exteriors?
We used the, yes, we did. We shot only all the wide shots. We had like a 24-hour shift in that jail. We shot all day and all night, which was what the we were advised to do. They felt if we'd come and gone too many times that the prisoners might have sort of started working out how everybody operated and which pieces of equipment might be used to damage them, or themselves or us. So that was the idea, that we came in one go, shot all day, all night, all the wide shots, because it's an incredible jail. The interior is like the Sistine Chapel, packed with cages, which was the central image that attracted me. You know, this story, which was about a woman who was deeply religious and who was reading the Bible to inmates in this sort of cathedral-like place. But then the rest was a set, a beautifully designed set by Luciano Righi.
The people who you work with on Little Women, I mean, the producer and the writer are women. Mm-hmm. So I guess things have really changed a lot in the film industry.
Well, I think even more than the producer and the writer being women, it was even more important that the people in power at the studio were women.
Oh.
Lisa Henson, who's sort of second in command at Columbia, and Amy Pascal, whose baby it was, and Amy actually developed the script with Robin Swycord and had been trying to make the film for 6 or 7 years, were the people that really made it happen. And that was a big change to when I'd been working with a Hollywood studio before. Although there was one woman who was in power at MGM when I made Mrs. Sofel, but it was very rare.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
No, it's a pleasure. And I'm sure you're beautiful.
No, I'm really not. I'm not saying that to be modest. I mean,
no.
It's just that I think, you know, most people aren't. And that's why it's so odd sometimes to see only beautiful people play plain people.
Oh, no, I agree that we know there should definitely be, I mean, a greater range of of all types of women on the screen, and the more unusual looking they are, the better, I think.
Director Gillian Armstrong, her latest film is Little Women.